What you are about to hear is a recording of the panel presentation, Best Practices for Language Access in Michigan Courts, that was presented as a part of the State Bar of Michigan 2014 annual meeting. Panelists included the Honorable William G. Kelly, Judge, 62nd B District Court, and member of Michigan Supreme Court Foreign Language Board of Review, the Honorable Christopher P. Yates, Judge, 17th Circuit Court, member of the Michigan Supreme Court Foreign Language Board of Review, Angela S. Tripp, Managing Attorney, Michigan Poverty Law Program, Program Manager, Michigan Legal Help Program, and Donna Bose, Certified Interpreter and Owner of Fidelity Language Resources, LLC, and also a member of the Michigan Supreme Court Foreign Language Board of Review. The audio begins with Judge Kelly describing certified interpreters.
Sometimes someone will be qualified rather than certified simply because that particular language does not have a certification test. Sometimes we simply can't find somebody who is certified, so we have to fall back to what we describe as the silver standard, a qualified interpreter. Now, in the case of a certified interpreter, you actually have the State Court Administrative Office placing its imprimatur on somebody to serve as an interpreter. With qualified interpreters, they've registered, and so we know they're out there, and we know they have some measure of experience, but we don't know how proficient they are as interpreters, and so it's incumbent upon the court to conduct a voir dire to make sure that the interpreter is capable of serving the function of an interpreter in the courtroom. The other alternatives for qualified interpreters, as you'll see as you work your way down 1.111A7, is it also can be a person who works for an entity that provides in-person interpretation services, provided that, and again, the same standards are laid out there, including the requirement of voir dire. So I think that Donna Boss will talk to you today about how there are services that can provide interpreters, and our court takes advantage of those services. There are some places that have several available. And so if we need someone to interpret in Russian, we can call a service up and they'll find a Russian interpreter. Yes?
Question. So for the efficacy of the proceeding, if you're the judge on the bench and the first inquiry is that you are qualified and not certified, I go through.
Correct.
Your, you know, we just got a central sending. So
yes.
I'm assuming then that there was not a certified available.
Yes.
Am I safe in that proceeding for that purpose?
Yes, and I'll get to that rule in just a moment, but yes, the general rule is that we're supposed to try to find a certified interpreter. So assuming that you've let us know in advance of the proceeding, we should either have a certified interpreter there and tell you that it's a certified interpreter. I'm sorry.
Can you go back up?
Oh, sure. Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry, I didn't know that slide was up there, but I appreciate having it. Right now, the State Court Administrative Office has certified 62 interpreters in six languages. And you can see, if, for example, you want somebody to interpret from Japanese to English and English to Japanese, it's going to be very difficult to find a certified interpreter. We have one in the entire state of Michigan. Now, if it were a high-profile criminal trial, I think there's a good chance we would be willing to get the certified interpreter to do it. But if you're talking about routine proceedings, in all likelihood, we're going to wind up using a qualified interpreter rather than a certified interpreter in Japanese. Okay? So, I've now talked about services that have a collection of interpreters. And then finally, the third category of qualified interpreters are people who work for an entity that provides interpretation services by communication equipment. Now, how many of you have ever had a court proceeding where a language line was involved or some similar service? All right. So at least half of you have some experience with LanguageLine. LanguageLine is a service that's available telephonically that can provide someone who is able to interpret in virtually any language on the face of the planet. Now, the advantage of LanguageLine is that we know that we're getting reasonably talented interpreters, and we can find somebody even in the most difficult languages to find interpreters. The downside of it, of course, is it's telephonic. It's not in person. We would much rather, particularly in the context of a hearing or a trial of significance, prefer to have live interpretation in the courtroom. All right. If you cannot find someone who is either certified or qualified, you can fall back to what we describe as the TIN standard. And the TIN standard is, unfortunately, the way things often used to go before the court rule was adopted. And that is, find somebody, anybody, who appears to be proficient in the foreign language. Now, if you go to Michigan Court Rule 1.111F, and you can find it in your materials, you can see the court rule that defines these preferences. The preference in the first instance is for a certified interpreter. In the absence of an interpreter, the court may appoint a qualified interpreter, but then the court shall make a record of its reasons for using a qualified foreign language interpreter instead of a certified interpreter. And then finally, in subsection 2, if neither a certified foreign language interpreter nor a qualified foreign language interpreter is reasonably available, and after considering the gravity of the proceeding and whether the matter should be rescheduled, the court may appoint a person whom the court determines through voir dire to be capable of conveying the intent and content of the speaker's words sufficiently to allow the court to conduct the proceeding without prejudice to the limited English proficient person. What does that mean? What it means is this. If you have a very simple matter, let's say, for example, it's a district court proceeding where you wish to set bond, and you know in all likelihood that you're going to set a low bond that will enable you to release the person rather than continue to hold them. In a circumstance like that, I think it would be appropriate to use almost anybody who's available because, of course, you're trying to do something helpful for somebody by releasing them on bond. And so if they happen to have a brother or an uncle or somebody like that, it may be all you have in the moment. Now, anytime you're doing anything more significant than something like that or just rescheduling a hearing, you really ought to have at least a qualified interpreter. And I think the courts will interpret the rule to mean that. But I can tell you on occasion I've had somebody show up out of the blue on a family docket for a hearing, and it's immediately apparent that they don't speak a word of English. It's also immediately apparent that they have a friend along who can interpret. I will not conduct substantive hearings. All I'll do is I'll use that relative after voir dire simply to convey the information, we're going to have this hearing next Friday. Please come back to court at 9 o'clock next Friday, and we'll have a qualified interpreter present. So even though the rules do allow this so-called TIN standard interpreter, somebody who is neither certified nor qualified, in other words, coming in completely under the radar, you can, as a judge, use that person, but only in the most limited circumstances. All right. The only other point I want to make before I cede the lectern here is I want to talk about something in Michigan Court Rule 1.111F in sections 4 and 5, because this has to do with compensation of interpreters. This was a significant sticking point for the Department of Justice, which takes the position across the country that courts simply should provide free interpreters no matter what. The Michigan Supreme Court was given three alternatives from our committee. One was the Department of Justice's wish list. The middle ground was that the courts would pay in the first instance and there would be some opportunity for the court to collect back the interpreter costs after the case was over, only from people who are not indigent. And then the third standard was that we would provide interpreters only in proceedings where people also had the right to court-appointed counsel. In other words, we gave them a Goldilocks menu of options, and they chose the middle one. So, under the middle option, what now is the law in Michigan is this. Courts must find the interpreter in the first instance and pay for the interpreter in the first instance, but the court may order a party to reimburse for payment of interpretation costs if the party is financially able to pay. So there are lots of definitions of how that works. The Supreme Court defined a poverty level where people absolutely couldn't be charged back, And there's also consideration given to circumstances where charging somebody even after the fact for an interpreter would impair their rights to the court system. I think what you'll find is the default position is that the court pays. So that's all I have to say on this little walk through the court roll. If you have questions, I'll be glad to take them later, but I want to make sure everybody gets their fair share of the time allotted. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Yates, for that overview of the court rules. Judge Kelly, would you like to add to that description?
Yes, certainly. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, there are different types of interpreters. One is simultaneous, and that is what we often see in court where people the court is talking in English and the interpreter is speaking right away in Spanish or whatever the target language is to the defendant. Consecutive is what those of you who've used Language Line have used. It's consecutive. You say something, say a couple sentences, a short phrase, and then you stop and the interpreter speaks in the target language to the other person. And the person speaks back to the interpreter, and then they speak back in English. So that's consecutive. Escort is what you might see in a tour guide when somebody is speaking in the target language, and then the interpreter would summarize in English. Escort is not sufficient. We don't want to have, and that's what you were talking about, where the judge was going on, or they were going on and on and on, and then the answer came back, yes. That would be escort. How big of a issue is this in Michigan? Well, we have 106,000 people in the state of Michigan who are primarily in Spanish, 40,000 in Arabic. As you know, we have the largest concentration of Arabic speaking people outside of the Middle East. And they're centered, of course, in the Dearborn, Western Wayne County area. We have a sizable population of Chinese. And then there's about 10,000 Vietnamese, Polish, Korean, German, Japanese, and so there's a number of, several creation is down the list, it's 5,700, but I think 5,729, I think 5,700 are here in Kent County. There's 5,428 Russians, and I think they're centered in certain areas. So we have quite a diverse population here. In fact, in some states, when they look at their numbers, it's like 80% Spanish and 20% other languages. Here in Michigan, we really have a diverse population. It's only 35% who are Spanish-speaking people. Then this smattering of other languages. So other states, all they have to do is get a core of Spanish-speaking interpreters, and they're 80% of the way there. Here in Michigan, it's a lot more difficult. Here in Kent County, we have a lot of refugees from various wars being brought in by Bethany Christian Services. And so whenever there's a conflict in the war, we know that we're going to be hearing somebody in that language here in Kent County pretty soon. And this is split out. Region 1 is the Detroit area. There are 177,000 people who are limited English proficiency in that area. Region 2 is Lansing, Flint, Jackson area. Region 4 is the Upper Peninsula area. Region 5 is Western Michigan. And you can see that we have 64,000 limited English people speaking in Region 5. In Wayne County, those of you who are from Wayne County, you see that you have a large percentage of limited English proficiency people speaking there. 26.3% of the statewide limited English population lives in Wayne County. And then there's 76 counties with less than 2% of the LEP population. So this is something that each area, each county is a little bit different. Okay. The challenges are there's a variety of languages. And we have to talk about in court. Now, Rule 1.111, which Judge Yates just explained, focuses on what happens inside the courtroom. But there's a lot of stuff that happens outside of the courtroom. There's the conferences with the attorney. There's conferences with witnesses. There's conferences with the probation department, and then being referred to agencies outside. It might be to an alcohol highway safety education program. Are those services available in other languages? Looking at forms, there's the State Court Administrative Office has published hundreds of forms. You can go on their website and look at all of them. And the challenge now is to determine which one of those forms should be interpreted into other languages and which languages should they be interpreted. It would be ideal to be able to interpret all of them into all of the languages. That's not going to happen. It's just a matter of not feasible. So the State Court Administrative Office right now is working on determining which ones have to be interpreted and in which languages. I think they're focused on about 7 different languages. And as time goes on, the number of forms that are interpreted will grow as will the different languages. Also websites. Number of courts and agencies have come up with websites. And now the challenge is to interpret those into different languages. And of course, there's the training for the interpreters, the training for the courts to determine how to implement this particular rule, and then evaluate how well it's all being done. Some ideas about when you're working with an interpreter. How many of you are interpreters, by the way? Looks like we've got 1, 2, 3 interpreters here. Correct me if I'm wrong. But it's important to talk to the person, not to the interpreter. And take pauses, because the interpreter needs some time to be able to comprehend and then to send that message out. And allow the interpreter time to interpret. And take breaks. This is a very exhausting task to be interpreters. And in trials, it's common to have an interpreter 2 interpreters there, 1 each hour, switching back and forth. Is that correct? Yeah, I mean, you need it. Your brain can only take so much. I have twins, and both of them studied overseas and speak Spanish fluently, but one of them was telling me, "Dad, I'm tired. I've been speaking Spanish all day long." it takes a lot of energy to speak in another language. Another tip is to record both in English and in the target language. What that means is if the person is whispering into the person's ear, that can move things along very quickly because you have that simultaneous interpreting. But what happens if the person comes back and says the interpreter misinterpreted? And I was talking with a judge the other night who said that he had a case in which that issue came up on appeal, and it was an appeal from a case that was about 10 years ago, and the defendant said, "Well, I didn't speak English very well back then. I needed an interpreter, and the interpreter told me it such and such." They were able to go back, listen to the recording, and found out that the interpretation had been done properly. And so it's important to be able to preserve that record, that what was the interpretation done at that time. So one judge says that she wants to have the person, the interpreter, stand a little bit away from the defendant or the other person so that they have to speak out loud or be mic'd themselves. So there's forms, there's websites. Another way of doing this is by slideshows, and I'm going to get to that in just a moment, but I do want to talk about something that happened. This is a true story. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, on one Tuesday morning, I needed an interpreter in Kinyu, Rwanda. That is a language spoken in Rwanda. Later that morning, I needed an interpreter in Swahili. That afternoon, I needed an interpreter in Hakachin, which is spoken by about 150,000 people in northeast Burma, or northwest Burma by the Indian border. And then later that afternoon, I needed an interpreter in Urdu from Pakistan. The next day, I needed an interpreter in Nepali. This is all in one day. Notice I didn't say Spanish. I said all these other languages. I was able to get an interpreter in each of those languages within a couple of minutes by using LanguageLine. And these were arraignments. It was something relatively simple. And so I was able to get an interpreter in each of those languages. I did have to use the TIN standard this week. This is the first time I've stumped LanguageLine. I needed an interpreter in Trebo, which is a language spoken by 100,000 people in Liberia. And not even LanguageLine had an interpreter in Trebo. So I had to use the daughter. But so it's a good thing we have the TIN standard. There's a reason we put the TIN standard in there. So, this is how we... Is there sound here? This is where we need the sound.
Okay.
This should be back up a slide. And, well, anyways, there is a voice that accompanies this. Sound? Were you able to get the sound going earlier?
No.
Okay. So what's happening here is that this is playing on a slide program, yes, and there's a voice that's going along and is advising the people of their rights. You can hit it down there. And go through all the rights. You want to interpret here for us?
Usted ha sido traído a la corte acusado de un delito de menor cargo. Antes de que la corte le pregunte su deseo, la corte debe advertirle lo siguiente. El cargo que usted se encuentra, las penalidades...
Yeah.
Ahora la corte le va a advertir cuáles son sus derechos.
And so they're able to follow along, and what I'm doing is I'm going through the advice of rights form, which we would ordinarily do in English, but here it is, and it's saying you've been brought to court on a misdemeanor charge, the court's going to advise you of your rights and the penalties, advise you of the charge that you're facing. You have a right to have a trial by a judge. Pictures worth 1,000 words. There's our courtroom, or a trial by a jury of 6 people from the city of Kentwood. And there's our courtroom, and it shows a jury there. And so videos are, the slideshows are easy to make. They save time, save money. The rights are given clearly, both orally and verbally, and visually. And then a certified interpreter or qualified interpreter is used to advise the person of the charge, the penalties, and their rights. We have those, the advice slideshow, advice of rights in four languages, English, Spanish, Vietnamese, and Bosnian, because here in this community, we have a large population of Vietnamese and Bosnian. If I were in the Detroit area, I would certainly have it in Arabic some other languages. So, we'll have some questions later.
All right. Thank you, Judge Kelly. Now let's get practical. Angela has some very convenient ways to show us on how to request an interpreter and also how to use the Michigan Legal Health System.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I'm Angela Tripp. I'm the project manager of the Michigan Legal Health Program. And the Michigan Legal Help Program is a website and affiliated self-help centers that provide legal information and referral resources for people who are representing themselves in simple civil legal matters. We launched the Michigan Legal Help website a little over 2 years ago, and we're very happy to be launching Ayuda Legal de Michigan, which is our Spanish language version. It's been up since May, but we're doing an official launch on Monday. So. One of the primary goal of the limited English proficiency court rule was to increase the accessibility of Michigan courts for limited English proficient people, and that includes self-represented litigants. I'm going to talk about the new resources for Spanish-speaking self-represented litigants in Michigan. As we saw on Judge Kelly's slide, Spanish is the primary foreign language spoken in Michigan, and it accounts for about 35% of all of limited English proficiency people in the state. It would be ideal for us to have resources in multiple languages, but as both judges told us, and as probably everyone in this room knows, that's not really feasible given the capacity that we have at this time. So maybe someday, but for now, we're going with English and Spanish. I'm going to talk to you about the different kinds of resources available for Spanish speakers. Maybe, do we have any next?
We might.
Maybe we'll see a demo of two of them. We'll see. It'll be a surprise for all of us. Most of these are in place right now, and some of them are still in progress. So as I told you, the Ayuda Legal de Michigan website, on the website, on both English and Spanish websites, we have the request for interpreter, toolkits, and interviews. We do offer live help in Spanish. I'm going to talk a little bit about the foreign language forums that SCAO has created. I'll touch quickly on the Spanish-speaking community resources that are on Ayuda Legal. This is a screenshot of the homepage of Ayuda Legal. As you can see, it has everything that Michigan Legal Help has. We have all of the resources, the legal information resources, and the community organization resources. We have translated two of our videos, the welcome video and the going to court video. We're working on the others right now. And within the website, there are the same resources as Michigan Legal Help. There are toolkits, there are articles, common questions, information about courts, community resources, self-help centers, and other things. Do you want to click on the link to see if it works?
Okay, where's the link?
It's the title.
That?
Yeah. Spinning.
There we go.
Oh.
I got that. Maybe we can do that.
I'll just keep talking about it and see if it comes up. So the toolkits are packages of information on a particular topic. So we have a toolkit for someone who needs a divorce and doesn't have children. So within that toolkit, there are articles that people can read to learn about the divorce process, division of property, things like that. Oh, there it is. Yay. Can you go to, I don't speak Spanish. Can you go to that one? So this is always an interesting presentation
there
for me because I just sort of guessed what I'm pointing to. Yes, Emilia. Just don't even listen to the accent. So click on this toolkit. This is my spouse wants a divorce and we don't have any children, right? Because all the resources are geared toward, we want them to be county specific, so we ask people to select a county, so you can just click on any county.
Gave you a challenge there, and so here on.
Oh, thank you, Chris. So if you scroll down here, we have the articles to learn about divorce without children, mediation, division of property, what happens after your divorce. If you keep going down, we have common questions. They're just short question and answers. People have, they don't want to read a whole article, or they just have a very specific question. Our referral resources are still in English, so find a lawyer, community services, self-help centers, and courts. These resources are still in English. And underneath the common questions, we have our checklists, which are the step-by-step instructions to tell people what they need to do in order to follow through the court process. So prepare the forms, make copies, file them with court, service, etc. And can you go back up to the top? And we have all the same resources at the bottom, social media links, important things like that. One of the great things is that you can very easily toggle back and forth between English and Spanish. This is really helpful for anyone, especially someone who's helping another person use the website. So it's spinning, but it'll take us to the, here it is, my spouse filed for divorce and we don't have children. We're back to the exact same place we were, but this is the English version. So whether you start on the English version of the website or the Spanish, you can toggle back and forth between the two with ease. Thank you, Candace. Very good demonstration. Can you take back to the PowerPoint?
Good luck with that.
Look, it's right there.
Next. Should we go next?
Mm-hmm. We did not even practice.
It's best.
So we launched the website with about 60% of the content translated, and that's just a resource issue. We wanted to go ahead and get the most important things up first. So at this point in time, we have the Family Law Toolkit. The Ayuda Legal has these things in it. So Family Law Toolkits, divorce and custody for both plaintiff and defendant, personal protection order toolkits. Right now it's domestic relationship only and petitioner only, although we're working to get our other resources translated. The consumer law toolkits include garnishment, motion for payment plan, and answering a complaint to collective debt, those toolkits. The request for interpreter, obviously that was one of the most important ones. And we translated the article about getting your fees waived, and as I said before, the welcome video and the going to court video. And the request for interpreter form interview is currently the only interview that we have in Spanish on the website. Interviews are more complex to translate than articles because of the way they're set up. We are working on the divorce interview right now, which is the biggest, most complex interview we have. So if we can get that in Spanish, we can do anything. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have a few more interviews in Spanish. And I'll talk more about the forms that come out of those interviews in a moment. The next slide is about the I Need an Interpreter Toolkit. And that is, yeah, if you can click on that. And this is available in English and Spanish, and it has just a simple article that explains the process for requesting an interpreter and the court rules around requesting an interpreter. And it also has the interview. And that interview is available in English and Spanish. And do we have time to go through it? What do you think?
Yeah. Okay, over.
So click on that link. We'll do it in English just to make it easy on us. So if you click on this, click on the text there. We'll go to Law Help Interactive, which is the website where all of our interviews are hosted. And we can speed through this. We won't. It's a very short interview. It's a very simple form. We just wanted to give people an extra tool to make it really easy to request an interview. Okay. Tell people what they're doing. And you have to accept the terms of use for Live Help Interactive. On Live Help Interactive, you can save your files if you want to. There would never be a reason to if you're just doing this form because it's only about four questions. But some of the other interviews, it's really good to save because they can be very complex and take a long time. The first few screens just tell people what to expect in the interview. How long it will take, what forms they'll have when they're finished. So we can just sort of speed through those if you'd like. You have this very lovely Law Help Interactive lady who will walk you down the path to the courthouse. Some screens have a Learn More button, and if you click on that, you get other information. So
you want me to do that?
Yeah. What other activities can you get? What are the out-of-court services, basically? So we tried to boil down the court rule. You know, we made it part of the interview to help people understand it. You can hit continue. These are just more information about the translation services, interpretation services available. We reference the language access coordinator, which is a very important part of this process. This interview can also help people complete the review of request for interpreter form. So if their initial request for interpreter is denied and they need to review it, they can also use this interview. We were afraid that people might get confused and try to request an ASL interpreter, so we threw in a slide saying this is not where you need to be and telling them where they do need to be. And these are the categories of people that can ask for court interpreters. And this tells them what they'll get at the end, and it should take less than 10 minutes. It'll take us just a moment. This is a little screen that tells people how to use the interface if they have trouble. And so this is, now we get into our series of questions, whether you want the interpreter or the reviewer. What's the name of your court? And if you have a question, we'll learn more about you, you know, for your circuit court or any kind of circuit court.
What do you want me to put in there?
Or whatever.
Minimum circuit.
Yeah. I used to practice a lot in Minimum County, so it's always my default choices for these things. And your case number if you have it. If you don't have it, you can use a blank. What language do you use the interpreter to speak? Can you put it in your mouth? Enter your name. Your name, okay? It's annoying to do and. It's also, Michigan's at the top of the list. So if you just, you put it at the top, everyone should actually be having a Michigan address third. Well, but some people might not, so we had to have all of them. I want to know the form asks which type of person you are, party witness or other. And then that's it, we're finished. So scroll down a little bit. A little bit of instructions, you know, kind of file it with the court. And you can remember, the Spanish language interview is just like this, only obviously it's in Spanish. The Spanish language request for interpreter is a bilingual form, so it's in both English and Spanish. The request for interpreter forms are the only ones that are bilingual. I'll keep talking about this thing. It might take a minute. It usually doesn't take long. But in the end...
It's this netbook.
Okay. All right. So scroll down and you go to get your document.
Get that.
Scroll down a little bit. Get that. And it's the SCAO form completed with the information that kind of put it. And this is all of the interviews on the website are like this. So people can use these interviews to fill out their forms for divorce, answer to an eviction complaint. You know, the problem with demonstrating these is that you never know where it's going to open because it's not my computer. So the document is somewhere, wherever your downloads go.
Yeah, good one.
Yeah, so anyway, we'll skip this part. But what is on the computer somewhere is a completely filled-in request for interpreter form. The SCAO website has bilingual forms in Arabic, simplified Chinese, Korean, Serbo-Croatian, Spanish, English, and Vietnamese. And the Michigan Legal Help website links people to all of those forms in case they speak one of those languages. Okay, so scroll down here. We always have a blank page on top in case people are printing in public. There's a little instructional letter that tells them what to do next. And then there's the court form. It's a very simple form. And it's, you know, exactly what they need to file with the court.
Did you have a question now?
Did you just
say okay.
I'm curious to know, what does the QR stand for?
That takes them to a survey on the Michigan Legal Help website that asks them, after they finish their court procedure, to ask them how their experience was in court. Okay. We like to get information about, you know, how people feel at the end of their court proceeding.
All right, do we go out of this?
Yeah, let's go back to the PowerPoint. One of the other resources that we have available is Live Help in Spanish. Live Help is a chat-based feature where trained agents, who are primarily pro bono law students, help website visitors navigate the website, and they also answer other questions that don't require legal advice. In the first year of Live Help on Michigan Legal Help, we talked to over 3,000 people this way. These were different Live Help buttons. We do have an MLH employee who is bilingual in Spanish and English, and he's available to chat with the Spanish speakers. Our goal is to recruit additional law student volunteers who also are bilingual and can do chats in Spanish. We can always schedule, LifeHop is available from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., but we can always schedule a chat at a different time if someone needs a Spanish speaker. Can you go to the next slide? As Judge Kelly talked about, SCALE has a limited English proficiency court rule implementation work group, or committee, and they have a work group, which is the Forms and Materials Translation Work Group. And I'm very happy to be a part of that subgroup. It's one of its four primary tasks is to identify vital forms and documents for translation, and then establish priorities for that translation. The first round of forms has been created and translated. And they are the demands, notices, complaints, summons, answers, judgments, and order of eviction for non-payment of rent, termination of tenancy, and mobile home eviction. The general civil summons and complaints, the waiver of fees, the civil answer, civil default judgments, and motion and order for installment payments. Petitions for protection orders for adults, and orders for personal protection for adults. Motion to extend, modify, or terminate personal protection order, and the order that goes with that motion. And then all the forms that Michigan Legal Help uses to generate complaint to do divorce and custody cases. With the exception of the divorce and custody cases, all those other forms will be available in Spanish and Arabic on SCAO's website. Now, these forms cannot be filed with the court. People can only file English language forms with the court. They can only serve English language forms on the other parties. But the idea is that these forms can be used as an aid for LAP individuals to help them understand the court papers that they have received and, in some cases, created. The court, SCAO, also translated eight notices. Notice of foreclosure, civil court advice of rights, notice of parenting time violation, advice of rights regarding friend of the court, advice of rights after order terminating parental rights, both the juvenile and the adoption code, and what you need to know before filing a petition to appoint a guardian or conservator. And those notice of rights forms were translated into Arabic, simplified Chinese, Korean, and Spanish. The other tasks of the group are to recommend form development and revisions, development of other appropriate materials, and court rule changes to facilitate the use of the forms and documents that have been translated. And we're very happy to work with SCAO on this project. Ayuda Legal is the primary place for the educational materials, the other appropriate materials that help the forms be useful. Just like with Michigan Legal Help in English, people often need more than just forms in order to be successful in court and to feel like they've had access to the courts. And the last resource that we have is we are building our library of community resources on Ayuda Legal to include those that are geared towards Spanish speakers or have Spanish speaking capacity. So we're working on that, and that should be filled out more by the end of this year. I always like to end my presentation by talking about how people can help Michigan Legal Help, or help us, because it's a great resource because of the great collaborations that have built it. Always, number one is refer people to it. These are all the terms. Refer people to it, work with or help form a self-help center in your area, distribute flyers and cards, which we have in the back, and then stay connected to us. We have the ability, you can request more cards and materials from the website, and we have user's guides there. And thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Angela. Donna Boss, our next speaker, she is not only a member of the Foreign Language Board of Review, but she's also a certified interpreter and owner of Fidelity Language Resources, LLC. Donna, we'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about what it takes, the steps that one may take in order to become a qualified or certified interpreter, and also the code of professional responsibility for the interpreter.
First of all, it's an honor to have been invited to be here. It's an honor to serve on the Foreign Language Board of Review. It deals with one of my favorite topics in the world, and that's Spanish and languages. And I want to say, too, that I have actually looked at some of the forums on Ayuda Legal. I was in a courtroom one day and walked down to the hallway and found some translated instructions or motions for parenting time. And I didn't exactly agree with the way they translated parenting time. So I played with Google and I found Ayuda Legal and I found some of their translated forms.
Yeah.
So if nothing else, it helps maybe to standardize the vocabulary. So if an LEP person comes to court one day and the interpreter uses one word for anything, and then another day they have another interpreter who uses another word, that might be really confusing. So I really enjoy those forms, and it increases your vocabulary, and it's nice to know that they're out there. What to do to become an interpreter? First of all, you really do need to be bilingual, fully bilingual. High school Spanish is not going to do it. Even college teacher material Spanish is not going to do it. You have to have lived and worked, and you really need to be able to think in both languages. There's a whole list of criteria that the language board has put together to become an interpreter. First of all, you have to be over 18. I know there's a lot of high school, college age students that would like to do it, but you need to be at least 18. You're not supposed to have any felonies on your record. And believe it or not, once in a while, I'll come across an interpreter who I find out sort of accidentally had a felony or two and now has another one. That was the last time he worked for us. And the new thing this year is that SCAN was requiring registration. There have been a lot of interpreters in the state over the years, but nobody really knows who they are, nobody knows their capabilities, nobody knows how accurate they were, they're just there. Some of them are good, and some of them, I don't know. So SCAO is requiring an initial registration that's due at the end of this month. If not, there's a little fee for being late. And then there will be an orientation program that all interpreters have to attend at least once. Even people who are already certified will need to fulfill that requirement. And one of the big things that was passed, one of the big things to me that was passed by the Foreign Language Board of Review is continuing education. Sometimes people like to think, I got my degree, I got my certificate, I'm good. Well, I don't want to go to a dentist that got his degree 20 years ago and thinks he's good, or a surgeon, or any other kind of doctor. I don't really want, you know what I mean? So there is a requirement now for all interpreters to complete 10 hours of continuing education per year, and there are many opportunities to do that. You can study, take college classes in your foreign language. You can attend some MITN activities. MITN is Michigan Translator Interpreters Network. It's part of the ATA, which is American Translators Association. It's a network of interpreters. We meet monthly. There are many opportunities to get continuing education, focusing on different aspects of interpreting, like minimizing your accent in the target language or in English. And there are other ways, many ways, that you can get these credits, these continuing education hours. And it is a requirement. It will be on next year's form. You have between October 1st and September 30th of next year to get those 10 hours in. Six of them you could get at the MITN conference in October. There are workshops that MITN offers during the year to help you prepare for the interpreter exam. Those credits, those hours count too.
Flyers for that are in the back.
And there are flyers for that conference in the back. It's still not too late to sign up. I think you can still get in on an early bird special. And so that is part of the requirements to be certified. The actual certification process, beyond now the orientation and the registration, the next step in becoming a certified interpreter is a written English proficiency exam. You might think that's a little odd, but people coming from a foreign country need to know English. And they need to know English to a level that they can really understand the concepts that are used in court, not just the words. There's one that's been troubling me for a while, is the word mean. the judge says, I need this information to put in lien. And what I know for lien is a lien against a house, or it's not the same thing, until I discovered that it's spelled differently and that it's an acronym. Okay, so now I can more adequately put into Spanish what the judge is talking about. I need your eye color, hair color, height, weight for lien. Okay. You need to know, and the problem that Scale had in the past was that people would sign up to do the oral test, but their English proficiency was so low that they were all failing. So since 2007, the state has required you to take an English proficiency exam before you do anything else. It's written, it's free, offered twice a year in Lansing. There are 135 multiple choice questions. They go over general language in English, synonyms, antonyms, slang, idioms, some terms for guns, court, drugs, not much. And then there are court-related terms. There are questions about procedures in court. Does the trial come before the arrest or after the arrest, before the sentence or after the sentence? If you're going to interpret in court, you really need to have a good idea of how the whole process works, because you can't interpret something that you don't understand. It's trying to interpret a cloud or something. You can't get a hold of it. So that exam, you have to pass it by 80%. If you pass that exam, then you are invited to take an oral exam. Now, the oral exam is what really kills most people and what many people are afraid of. It has three sections. There's a section called site translation, where you're given a document in English. It could be a police report, a pre-sentence report, a lab report, a witness statement. It could be anything. You're handed this document in English, and you have to look at it and interpret it out loud in your target language. And then there's one in the target language, and you have to look at that and interpret it back in English. Those many times are handwritten notes or typed notes from an LEP person in their language, many times not written correctly in that language, not spelled correctly, no punctuation, words all run together, and you have to look at that and read it out loud in English. And then the next section is the consecutive interpreting, which, as Judge Kelly mentioned, would be witness testimony for the most part, or video arraignments. In a witness testimony, you have the attorney asking the questions, the interpreter interprets the question, the witness answers it, you interpret it back, and it goes back and forth. And the questions on the exam for those attorneys are really long, complicated, frustrating questions that I keep thinking, I hope no attorney ever really does this. But they do. They really do, and it's really hard. But in real life court, you can kind of like make, you know, signal their witness to stop a minute so I can get this. On that exam, there's no stopping the witness. They just talk, or the attorney. So there's that section. And then the third section of the test is simultaneous, which many people find hardest. To me, it was my favorite section. Is many times like an opening statement or closing statement that you would have in a trial or in jury instructions. And when the person is speaking in English, the interpreter is just simultaneously interpreting it in the target language. All of that's recorded. All of that is sent away with an ID code to two professional graders who are trained, certified interpreters and trained to grade these exams. And they will listen to it, and they will grade it. And in the exam, in the text, when you're taking the test, you don't see it. But the graders have a copy of the text, and certain words are underlined. There's certain points assigned to different words. So the test is carefully crafted to test your ability in the grammar, in context, in making the language flow. It shouldn't sound like chopped up Spanish. It should sound like a native speaker would sound, and English the same way. And so they grade that and they send that back. You have to take all three of the sections. You have to take all three sections in one sitting. There are some states that break it down and let you do it one at a time. I think they have more certified people than we do, because if you only had to work at it one at a time, it wouldn't be that hard. But you really have to do all three of them, and it's hard to do all three of them. Anyway, they grade it. You have to pass each section by 70% or more. And if you pass all three sections, you are now a certified interpreter. And the certification is permanent. All you have to do is keep up with the other requirements to register, to do your continuing education, and you're certified. It doesn't mean you're automatically, magically a great interpreter. Some people don't want to take the test because they say it doesn't mean anything. It's a piece of paper. Well, it is a piece of paper. So is your law degree. So is your high school diploma and your college diploma. But those papers demonstrate a minimum level and they're necessary. What I found was studying to get that piece of paper and preparing to get that piece of paper is what helped me to improve my abilities and my performance. Originally, I hoped that the paper would just automatically make you good, but it didn't work. You need to work to get a certification. If you don't pass all three, you have to take it again. If you manage to pass two out of the three, if you pass the site translation in either of the other sections with 70% or more, they give you a provisional certification. It's good for 3 years. You can say I'm a certified interpreter because you are certified provisionally. And you have those 3 years to retake the one section of the test that you failed. And so it's workable. Most people that I know did not pass the exam outright the first time. A very, very few people just went in there and passed the whole thing. And a couple of them, I don't even really think they're that good, so they must just be good at testing. But that's it. You have to pass all three of them. In Michigan, we don't have a lot of certified interpreters. Judge Kelly had a figure. I have a number similar to that I found off the website last night, and the majority of them are in Spanish. And I looked at some stats as to how many people passed the test each year since it was probably first administered in 2000. Some years, 5 people passed it. 1 year, nobody passed. The average is 3.2. The exam's offered twice a year, once in the spring, early summer, once in late summer, fall. And the last time the exam was administered, 1 person out of 20 passed the Spanish exam. So it has a very low pass rate. Now, if we keep at that rate, it's going to take a long time before we get very many certified Spanish interpreters. And the other languages are even less. And we can't even test for all languages. Well, we really can't test for all languages because Ethnologue, who's the linguistic authority, says there are now over 7,100 living languages in the world. So there's no way in the world that we're going to be able to test all 7,000. But the state does offer the oral exam. Well, anybody can take the English exam, but the oral exam, the state has 17 languages that offers. Currently, we have like 8 languages that are certified. We have 1 Arabic interpreter, a French, Japanese, a Mandarin, a Polish, 3 Russian, or 2 Polish, 3 Mandarin, 3 Russian, and 48 in Spanish. I think a couple of them just passed since Judge Kelly, well, 1 passed. And sometimes the numbers change on scale depending on what day you're looking at it, but this was the latest number. Of these first 6 languages, most of the people who are certified live over in the east side of the state. So when we come back to the court rule and they're talking about reasonably available, is the court in Grand Rapids going to pay the certified interpreter in Japanese to drive to Grand Rapids for a domestic violence arraignment? Probably not, because I don't know that that's reasonable. And many of the interpreters on the east side of the state charge more than on the west side, so I don't know what's reasonable. Every court has to decide that. But in many areas in this area, Grand Rapids is listed as having about 8 interpreters who are certified for Spanish, except that 4 of them have full-time jobs in other fields, so there really aren't 8. There are about 4. And all the different courts we have and district courts. I also looked at district courts and how many there are in the state. There are 100. District courts in Michigan. So if you have 68 Spanish interpreters, that's less than one per court as an average. And we can look at that. There is a shortage of interpreters. And I guess the thing, well, I was also going to talk a little bit about the code of ethics and tips for using interpreters, especially related to the code of conduct and ethics for interpreters. We are not the law clerk, legal assistant, secretary of the attorneys. I don't mean to be mean about that, but many times attorneys will say, "We've gone with this to my client." One time I did. I helped the lady because she was walking with a cane. She was having a hard time getting around. So I went and I read the client was in the lockup box. I read that PSI to him. Come back and she goes, "Well, do you have any questions?" That wasn't my job, okay? It's not my job. In fact, the rules do not really allow us to talk to your clients about legal things. We can't give them legal advice. We can't repeat your legal advice if you're not there with the LAP. You can't just give me a message, "Well, tell my client so-and-so." We're not allowed to do that. We might, if we're trying to be nice and helpful, because interpreters really want to help, but legally we're not allowed to do that. One attorney one day told his client, "Well, if you don't understand what the judge is saying, just raise your hand and the interpreter will explain it." And I stopped him, we were in an interview, not on the record. I stopped him, I said, "No, I'm sorry, the interpreter won't." "No, no, you can explain it." "Like, no, I can't. We're not allowed to do that." There is a 8-page updated version of the rules for interpreters, but the conduct. There are many things in there. One of them is we are not to give legal advice. We're not supposed to do the job of the attorneys. We don't have that degree. We don't have that authority. We don't have that permission. And part of the registration form every year is that all interpreters have to read and sign and agree to obey the code of conduct. One of the things that is, I guess, frustrating overall, I'm very pleased with the new court rule. I'm thrilled that it gets priority to certified interpreters, not just because that helps me in my business, but it really is what we should be doing. And I really want to encourage all the courts and all the attorneys to make every reasonable effort to get a certified interpreter whenever it's possible. Now, because of the number of LEPs we have and the little number of interpreters we have that are certified, that's not going to be possible. And I can't do it all, and I would like all the courts in this area to call us the certified interpreters, but the truth is we can't cover them all. Because everything starts at 8:30 in the morning, or it starts at 1:30 or 2 in the afternoon, and you can't physically get to all the places, especially if the hearing doesn't start on time, because somebody's missing, or whatever reason, you know, you have to have some space between the assignments, and the courts are usually a little more forgiving to attorneys that are late for hearings because they were in another court. They're not quite as forgiving to the interpreters who are late for hearings because they were in another court. So we all need to work together on that. And some of the courts are really 100% complying with the certified interpreter rule. Some of them, even before the rule came out, were insisting only certified Spanish. Now, I'm glad that is possible to do. Only certified Spanish. And there's one court that if I as an agency don't send them a certified Spanish interpreter, they're asking the interpreter, "Where's my certified one? How come I didn't get a certified interpreter?" The interpreter I sent doesn't really know. So now I have to fill out a form. Every time I send someone from the qualified list, I have to send a form with them saying there was not a certified interpreter available in your county or the three adjacent counties. So I'm sending you a qualified interpreter. I guess that's about the end of my time.
Can I ask one quick question? That form that you just mentioned, is that a form that the state or?
I devised that. The judge in the referee in that court, one day we were discussing it because she kept asking all these other people about it. So I asked her what she would like in the form, and I made the form.
Thank you to our panel. We have about 5 minutes left of this forum. And before we end, I just wanted to pose to Judge Yates and or Judge Kelly, I wanted you to talk a little bit about judicial discretion in determining whether to appoint or engage a court interpreter for different under different circumstances? And also, what do you do if a party or a witness says that they would like to waive LEP status? So either one of you.
Well, let me take the second question first. There is a waiver provision in the new court rule. As you know, virtually every constitutional right can be waived. And in Mission Court Rule 1.111 for a C close, there is a provision for waiver, but it's important to understand that a right like that can be waived, but you still have to make sure that you're having a meaningful court proceeding. So I would be loath to accept a waiver unless I were absolutely convinced the person could understand one way or another what was going on. In terms of discretion, we tried in drafting the court rule to provide some flexibility, but not so much flexibility that the requirement for looking first for a certified interpreter and then second for a qualified interpreter can be ignored. So if it seems that there's some tension in the rule on that point, it's intention. That's how it was designed to operate. And I think that, although we don't have any appellate decisions on it yet, I think that most of us in the judiciary are trying to be careful to comply with the step-by-step process and find a certified interpreter. I know if I use a certified interpreter, my record is safe. If I use a qualified interpreter, I have to worry a little bit about my record. I have to explain why I haven't used a certified interpreter. And if I'm using a 10 standard interpreter, as Judge Kelly so aptly described it when we were working on the rule, I know that I may very well have a problem down the line with it. So I would only do that in the simplest of cases. Judge Kelly may have a different view, but that's how I approach it.
Thank you.
Well, I think it's very important that people understand what's going on. I was one of those that started Spanish in high school for a couple years, so I grew up with the Spanish people. I had a chance to visit a court in Spain once, and I sat in and I understood nothing but what went on in the proceedings. My daughters are fluent in Spanish, but they said that they were in trouble in a court in Spain, that they would not get out an interpreter that was just help out. Remember, Amanda Knox was fluent in Italian, and the first trial, I think she spoke. She testified in English. The second one, she testified in Italian. It's one thing for someone to be proficient in English enough that they can go to work, that they can go to the grocery store and they can function in society. It's another thing that they're able to function in the courthouse. It's not enough that they're able to understand 90-95% of what's going on. The last 5 or 10% can be critically important. And so I think it's important that they have an interpreter, and even if they're on the and I have some people who are right there. Number one person said, I need to interpret in Dutch. And after he sat in court for a few minutes, he says, okay, I'm comfortable. I understand what's going on. And it was that he was speaking the same English, not that he was able to understand. I'm sure that he knew that we're going English, we're both slow, and if you need an interpreter, please let me know what we'll get on.
Thank you, Judge Yates and Judge Kelly. Are there any questions from the audience?
Well, I was kind of going to touch on that because, you know, the judges I work with, they want to know, what do I have to do? Not like, what should I do? What do I have to do? And so, you know, the question has come up all the time, what constitutes practicable in terms of making a certified interpreter available? I'm out in the thumb. The closest certified interpreter to my court is an hour away in Lake Orion. And so then the question is it practical to bring in someone from an hour away in Lake Orion? Define practicality. You know, if you can throw enough money at it, yeah, we can get them here. And I'll let you speak to that first.
What type of hearing are you talking about?
Well, I guess that was kind of the next thing that I kind of wanted to ask about a little bit, because one thing that you guys brought up in your conversation was the level of complexity of the hearing, but the court rule really doesn't say anything about the momentousness of the hearing. It just talks about practicality or reasonable availability. In my case, it has come up in the context of, and that was actually another debate, it was a juvenile delinquency matter in which the juvenile speaks English, but the parent of the juvenile does not. So then there was this debate about, is the parent of a juvenile delinquent a party to the action? And, you know, everyone recognizes that we should do these things, but then the question became, do we have to?
The reason I ask what type of hearing is, if it's an arraignment, a qualified interpreter might be appropriate. If you're talking about a trial where you have notice ahead of time that the trial is going to be freely from Thursday, you have time to arrange for that interpreter to come up from the board, and it's going to be a long enough proceeding that, and it's going to be an important enough proceeding. And so as judges point out, we're trying to build enough flexibility into it that if it's a request for adjournment, the arraignment comes up right now, we don't have to bring that person in.
Right. If you look at the language of 1.111 F1 and 2, that sliding scale is built in. In F1, it says that the certified foreign language interpreter is not reasonably available after considering the gravity of the proceedings and whether the matter should be rescheduled. The court may appoint a qualified foreign language interpreter. And in 2, again, it says if neither a certified foreign language interpreter nor a qualified foreign language interpreter is reasonably available, and after considering the gravity of the proceeding and whether the matter should be rescheduled. That language was put in there just to make sure that courts understood that it's one thing to use a tin standard interpreter if all you're doing is resetting hearings. It's quite another matter if you're going to have a criminal trial, for example.
Okay. You have a question?
An hour drive is not that bad for me. I've driven from Rapid to Tennessee, and three. You take mileage.
And that's kind of what we're, you know, that's the debate, is like, how far is far enough that we're off the hook and don't have to bring someone in or not? You know, there's that. Because I've got judges who are paid very close attention to the budget. So.
What about the part of Adam's question relating to the parent of the juvenile? The parent's not a party.
Right. That also was contemplated and covered in the rule. Party means a person named as a party or a person with legal decision-making authority in the case of court proceeding. So we expressly contemplated a parent in juvenile delinquency proceeding as somebody who would be covered.
Is there another part of it that talks to witnesses and people with an interest that might cover that too?
Yep. Right. I mean, as somebody who did family casework for years as a judge, I know, for example, in a juvenile delinquency proceeding, it's important to have a parent have an interpreter. Or in child protective proceedings, for example, there are other people who would need to be considered. He too is now what Judge Kelly is pointing out. The court may appoint a foreign language interpreter for a person other than a party or witness who has a substantial interest in the case of court proceedings. So in child protective proceedings, you could even appoint somebody for someone who is not one of the parents.
And when we talked in our discussion with the deliberations, we talked about Amanda Knox's parents. They didn't speak Italian. Would you want to have an interpreter for the parents so they could understand what's going on? And then use that as an analogy of if your son or daughter were a trial here in Michigan in English and they spoke in language, would you want to know what's going on?
I would absolutely want to, yes.
And the court may appoint an interpreter in that type of
situation. And that's what that is, the court. In the juvenile interpretation,
this
court allows the juvenile to
interpret
for his parents. That's not
really a good idea. One of the things I didn't touch on in the rule is there are disqualifying conflicts. And if you look at 1.111E, you'll see, for example, the interpreter is a friend, a family member, or a household member of a party or witness. And that's a disqualifier.
Well, we'd like to thank our panel. Let's give them another round of applause. Judge Yates, Judge Kelly, Angela Church on the Boss, thank you so much for your time and commitment to this issue. We'd like to thank the State Bar of Michigan, Candace Crowley, Gregory Conyers, the staff. We thank you so much for all of your help. Without you, this wouldn't have even come into existence. We'd like to thank Erica Davis, co-chair of the Committee on Justice Initiatives, for also helping to push this issue and making sure that this came to existence. I'd like to thank Aaron Burrell, co-chair of the Equal Access Initiative. Thank you, Aaron. And thank all of you.
And there are a lot of materials in
the back. Please help yourself to them. I'm sure we'll have a surplus. And I think our panel, if you have any remaining questions, they might be able to stick around to answer some of your questions. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Thank you, Maya.